intersections are those times when we have multiple choices for the direction that we will take, and then we have to decide. This podcast will explore the many intersections in people's lives. Some are pleasant, others are hair-raising, all are important. I'm Brett Dickerson, your host. We're talking to Ryan Kiesel today, director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oklahoma. Ryan, glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your background. You were once a legislator. You're an attorney. Is that right?
Yeah, all of those things. Grew up in Seminole, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and graduated from Seminole High School and mm-hmm. went to the University of Oklahoma and OU College of Law. And while I was there, I got this crazy idea to run for the legislature and served in the Oklahoma legislature in the House, representing House District 28, which was then Seminole County, northern Pottawatomie, southwest Lincoln, and western Okefuskee counties. And
now,
I did
Ryan,
that
you
from
actually,
04 to 10.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I did that from 2004 to 10.
Yeah.
Now, 3 terms.
Now, you actually won that race while you were still in, was it law school?
I was in law school, yeah.
Yeah. You're still in law school, mm-hmm. and you ran for office and won.
Which there's something
so
in the
how
water
did you,
there.
How did you yeah. juggle all of that? That's amazing.
I don't know. I think the answer to that is I don't know. You know, I'm grateful that everything in my life has happened in the order that it has happened, because I feel like I've got the commensurate energy for whatever is going on at any given time. If you had asked me right now to shape-shift back to 2004 with my with what I've got currently going on in my life and run for the legislature as a law student, you'd be out of your mind. There's no way. I don't think I could do it. But at the same time, now I'm the director of a nonprofit, and we have certainly a full plate in Oklahoma. And I've got two young kids. I've got a four-year-old and a little girl that's 10 months old. And between the two of them, they probably take more of my time than law school did. So who knows? I mean, I felt like whatever span of life that I'm in, I've got the commensurate energy to match up to it.
Tell me who's on your staff. Well, first of all, before we get to that, why is the ACLU in Oklahoma? You know, some people say, you know, that's the reason why I moved to Oklahoma is because it's a red state, it's a conservative state, and then I get there and I find the ACLU here in Oklahoma. How come the ACLU is here in Oklahoma?
I'm glad they found us. We're in every state. The American Civil Liberties Union has affiliates in all 50 states. We have a presence in American territories as well, in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. We've decidedly, as a national organization, invested in those areas and those regions where the ACLU is often needed the most, and Oklahoma is certainly one of those.
Yes. I would agree with that. How is the ACLU funded? You know, they're in the Soviet Union anymore. Once upon a time, people thought the Soviet Union directly funded you guys.
Yeah, well, and you'd be surprised by the number of folks that think Congress directly funds us. They think that we're a federally appropriated agency, and fortunately, we're not. We have we're funded a couple of ways in Oklahoma. We are fortunate enough to have a very deep pool of individuals who are committed to our cause, who believe that regardless of what these folks that may have moved here think that they're moving into, you still have to abide by the Constitution, and you still have to abide by the Bill of Rights. And those things matter here, and mm-hmm. there has to be an organization that steps up to defend them whenever necessary. And so we have a very deep pool of very committed individuals and organizations and families that go out of their way to make sure that we stay in existence and grow. We also are subsidized by our national organizations. Mm-hmm. Several affiliates around the country receive a subsidy each year to make sure that we have a professional staff on the ground.
So George Soros doesn't just write a check for all.
I wish. I wish. Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Okay. Well, Ryan, it just seems like to me that being the director of the ACLU mm-hmm. in Oklahoma, especially, that would be just a perpetual hot seat.
It is. Yeah. You know, I have. And as the organization in Oklahoma has grown in prominence and activity over the last couple of years, the intensity that comes with the job has only grown. And so we've added staff, we've added programming, we're doing more than ever. But even then, it never really seems like it stops. And you know, I had, beginning earlier this year, there was, 2015 has just been, ACLU, there's the Modest Mouse album, Good News for People Who Love Bad News. Well, you know, we fit that, right? So whenever there's bad news, I mean, that usually means that we're doing the most of our work. The majority of our work is happening in response to some really bad news. And earlier this year, we had some really bad news. We had a pay-to-play deputy in Tulsa County shoot and kill a man. We had a fraternity at the University of Oklahoma, not only in the racist chant that they had, but also in the fallout of that. We learned a lot about the existing and the perpetuation of racism on college campuses in Oklahoma. And then we've had a string of executions and botched executions and attempted executions over the last several months. And then there's even more in between all of that. Sometimes it feels like you're on a beach. A few years ago, I got it in my head that I wanted to learn how to surf. So I went out and have gone several times since. And when you're learning how to surf, one of the hardest things to do is to get out beyond the break and be out where you can catch the wave. And you will find yourself just getting battered after wave after wave after wave, trying to get out there. And eventually you learn how to get out there into the deeper water and watch for your wave. And this year, 2015, has kind of felt like that for us at the ACLU. There's really been no break. It's just wave after wave after wave. And Ali Shin, our development director, she and I were visiting about this one day, and you know, she had some very wise advice for me, and that was to stop waiting for that break, because we're not going to get it. This is just the new normal for us. This is the speed at which we are operating. This reflects the importance of our organization in Oklahoma and the demands on our time and our energy. And I think that, you know, not only for me, but for our entire team, once we came to that realization that this is a new normal, this is our new speed, it's not slowed down, but it's made it a little bit easier to navigate over the last couple of months.
Just kind of take a breath every day jump in there and do it.
I try to practice yoga on a regular basis. get in two or three times a week to studios around Oklahoma City and ride my bike and run and get it out that way. And then I've got it's pretty easy to get home, and I can lose myself and my family and my kids. But it's a tough job. It's a demanding job, but it's incredibly rewarding, and I can't imagine myself being anywhere else right now.
Now, just on a personal level, I just noticed that you have some kind of a notice on your door that you have to make an appointment to just come to your office. Just anybody can't just walk into your office and say, "Hey, I want to talk to Ryan Kiesel." Why is that? Seems like something that's been from experience.
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple of reasons for that. First and foremost, we're a small team in Oklahoma, and we already have, like I was mentioning, a lot of demand on our time, and it's just wildly inefficient for us every time somebody who has a complaint shows up at the door for us to stop what we're doing, jump up, answer that complaint, try to get some resolution to them, or consider whether or not they have a case that we would be interested in taking. So we've got a complaint process. Folks can go to acluok.org, fill out a complaint online. If you don't have access to a computer at home, you can go to our library and do that. You can also mail it to us, physical mailing address. We've got a P.O. box online. So that's one reason. The other reason, I think is security. We know that in the defense of the Bill of Rights, that we are often angering a lot of folks who would much rather see our state and our people in a different period of history than in 2015. We are, from what I've been told, the only ACLU affiliate south of the Mason-Dixon that has a storefront office. That's not something that we worry a whole lot about, but we do take our security seriously. But at the end of the day, you can't let that dictate how you're going to operate and live your life and work. Right. Yeah, but we've put that sign up, and we've so that's Sometimes it works. Some people, I've watched people read it, digest it, and then bang on the door anyways. And what are you going to do?
It's kind of the way it goes, isn't it? Have you, you know, when I first saw that, I just happened by your office, and I'm not going to say where it is, but I just happened by your office one time and saw that sign, and I thought, well, that makes sense. Have you guys had death threats?
We've had some threats. I think the most serious threat we ever had, where we actually called the police in and evacuated the building, it was a threat that, it turns out, was made to the ACLU of Ohio. And I think that whenever they Googled, they got ACLUOH instead of OK. And so after we got the all clear, we were on the phone with our affiliate in Ohio saying, hey, listen, somebody who doesn't know their geography but does know that they hate the ACLU has contacted us. And so you just be on alert there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, the hate mail and the emails and the Facebook messages, you know, they're out there. And that's part of the job. Of course, we don't take it all that seriously unless there's a real threat there, and then we'll contact the authorities. And most of the time, we're just letting folks know, hey, this happened. Because at the same time, we're defenders of free speech.
Yeah.
And so if somebody can send us something, and, you know, we're going to be the last people to read into that it's an actual threat. And that it's worthy of a police officer knocking on somebody's door. Because, I mean, this is the way this works. We're doing what we're doing, and we feel that we're right in our cause, and people adamantly disagree with it, and they get to disagree with it with, you know, everything from profanity to bad grammar, and sometimes a little of both.
All right. So why don't we talk about your background a little bit? Did you grow up seeing adults in your family taking stands on particular issues like this?
Yeah. I think early on I've been I don't know if there's something in genetics about being a contrarian or what, but I do feel like I was a contrarian from an early age on any number of fronts. I grew up in a very small town, Seminole, Oklahoma, about 7,000 people. And one of my great uncles, who I just considered an uncle, was a gay man and lived with his partner in Dallas for as long as I can remember. And I think that there was something about growing up in a small town yet being connected to somebody who was gay and it not being any different, right? And so that had a strong impact on me growing up, especially whenever I would speak candidly and openly about my two uncles. Mm-hmm. And other people just thought that was an anathema to the way things ought to be. Yeah. And that was a real shock to me. I don't think I was really prepared for that. So it really set me on a path to appreciate being an underdog and fighting for underdogs.
Differences.
Total comfort level.
Mm-hmm.
One of my earlier memories, I'm a huge music fan. And so it's cool that we're recording here at ACM. But you know, one of my earliest memories was probably fourth or fifth grade, or one of my earliest dissonant memories anyways. We were doing our class picture, and I had recently bought the Nirvana Nevermind album, but I also had the T-shirt that went along with it. And anybody who's familiar with the album cover knows that it's a little boy in a swimming pool chasing after a dollar bill. And the little boy is totally naked, as he, you know, most infants are. I mean, that's just whatever. But I wore that to school for class picture day, and I'm a short guy, so I was always front row in these class pictures. And they told me that I had to take off my shirt or turn it inside out or do something. And so I did. I modified it so that you couldn't see it, but right before the picture was going to be taken, I switched it back again. And that was one of my early defiances to authority. I've had a problem with authority, especially arbitrary authority that goes against the things that I care about for a very long time. I can't remember a time when I haven't had that.
What was it that made you want to run for office as a Democrat? Now back then, Democrats were in the majority in the legislature.
Well, not when I got elected. They were when I was running.
But
the night I got elected was the night that the Democrats lost the majority in 2004.
Wow.
I remember getting a congratulatory phone call from Jerry Askins, who was at that time set to become the next Speaker of the Oklahoma House, the first female Speaker of the House in Oklahoma. And she was, and it was very gracious of her to pick up the phone and call me and say congratulations, because she was watching her speakership go down in flames that night.
Yeah,
and it all came down around him, and we ended up with 44 members out of 101 whenever I first walked into the House. I had wanted to run for office for almost as long as I can remember. In kindergarten, I dressed up as President of the United States. That was what for Career Day, what are you going to be?
Yeah.
And I had an astronaut helmet on and a suit. And I was going to be an astronaut and president. And here I am, neither one.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I've told my wife, if we ever make a lot of money, just a lot of money, just an obscene amount of money, I'm going to buy my way to space. I mean, that's, you know, I don't care if it's risky or if I'm one of the first folks but commercial space flight, I'm buying a ticket on that deal. I suppose if I got really rich, I could, you know, try to buy the White House too. There are people that are doing that.
Oh yeah.
It might be easier to buy a ticket to space though, and probably more fun.
I don't know.
Probably I wouldn't want to deal with Congress these days. So I decided to run for office.
Mm-hmm.
Ran as a Democrat. I've been a Democrat my entire life. Worked on Democratic campaigns. Had worked for Senator Kelly Haney whenever he was chairman of Appropriations.
Okay.
And what a cool job that was when I was in college and then heading into law school. I was his leadership staff. And when I was working for him was the time that he had just completed the Guardian and they were about to put it up on top of the dome.
Wow.
So part of my job was making sure that dignitaries and the public got a chance to go take a picture with the Guardian while it was still on the ground. And I got to climb to the top of the dome with Senator Haney that day whenever the crane lowered the Guardian down. I'd worked for Senator Bill Bradley when he ran for president in 2000 against Al Gore. So I was in Iowa and California and Washington State for that campaign. So there I was, 2004, decided I was going to run for office. And I think like a lot of Oklahoma Democrats, I felt like I needed to compromise on a lot of the things that I held true. I mean, I think people that know me really well know that I'm at heart a pretty liberal guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made a lot of compromises with myself and ran that first time and knocked every door. I think we knocked all of our target doors at least three times, some of them four times. Had a tough primary campaign, a tough runoff campaign, and then had a general election, won the general election in 2004. And that was one of the best times of my life. And, you know, there's something about running for office in your hometown. And from the moment I was born, I'd lived my entire life in Seminole, Oklahoma, a lot of it in the very same house that my folks brought me home from the hospital in. And there's still nothing like going around knocking doors and canvassing in small towns and getting to know your town and the surrounding towns. You know,
Cindy Munson, who I interviewed, you know, not long after she won this last election, she's my representative now here in Oklahoma City. She knocked clear through that district about five or six times.
Yeah.
And just
a little easier in the metropolitan district.
Simply, it's a lot harder when you're out there just driving from house to house.
Spent a lot of time.
Let me ask you something about that time, because you were running during a time when the Democrats had been in charge of the legislature all the way through. That doesn't mean that the legislature was always liberal, but the Democratic Party was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And so so when you are elected that night, you find out that you're not going to be a member of the majority party, but the minority party.
Right.
Now, when you arrived at the Capitol, what did you find when you got there? Did you find people getting organized as the opposition party, or did you find people who were just kind of dumbfounded and really didn't know what to do next?
I think that there was a very steep ramp up time to learning how to be a minority party. Opposition party.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was, we had some amazing individuals in our caucus, and some of them were made for the opposition party, And some of them really felt like, you know, we still had a Democratic governor, we still had a Democratic Senate, and, you know, I think that there was a sense that we as Democrats in the House, if we stuck together with our 44, could have still a relevant impact in the legislative process. And I think it took a while for us to realize that the Republicans hadn't waited 80 years to get control back of the House and to get total control, first time in state history, of the Senate and the House a couple election cycle later, and then to get every statewide office. They didn't wait all that time to sit around and make deals.
Right.
They came in, and then Speaker Todd Hyatt was pretty, I don't say heavy-handed, but I mean, it was, you know, to the victor go the spoils, and they took all the spoils.
So it was a major intersection for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
For the Republican Party, yes, in terms of them finally getting what they had been trying for 80-some years, but it was a major intersection for the Democratic Party, wasn't it?
Major intersection for the Democratic Party. You know, the Republican Party had to figure out how to govern, but not just yet, right? I mean, so the Republican Party, now in the majority in the House, they were still in this position where they were able to really hammer on and try to put the governor and the Senate in a really bad political position, right? So that was what they spent a lot of their time trying to do. The Democratic Party, I think, had an identity crisis. And I think to some extent still has an identity crisis in Oklahoma. And they, you know, if you look at my district, for example, my district is in rural Oklahoma. When I left the legislature in 2010, decided not to run for re-election, the legislator that when I left, the Oklahoma Constitution newspaper, which I normally don't read, but when they're doing their legislative rankings, you know, they rank folks as the most conservative and the most liberal. When I left, I was rated as the most liberal member of the House, and the guy who got elected after me, the gentleman who was elected after me, is one of the most conservative members of the House. And I think that, you know, we're seeing that in rural Oklahoma. The Democratic Party hasn't been there yet, hasn't got to that point yet where they realize that their new majorities are going to be built in metropolitan areas. They're going to be built with women. They're going to be built with a more diverse community. And certainly in 2004, we didn't see that. And there was a real sense that what the Democratic Party needed to do to either hold on to what they had or to, you know, try to get back to the majority. I don't ever really remember a plan of trying to get back to the majority at that point. It was just hold on to what we got. Yeah, you know, that was there was a majority that thought that the best way to do that was to confuse ourselves with Republicans and to adopt and co-opt Republican messages around social issues in particular didn't really fare well as a political strategy,
but that's my question, is that an effective opposition party?
Absolutely, it's not. I think it's intellectually dishonest, and it was. You know, it was during that time. You know, when I got elected, I was very much of the mind that. You know, I got elected to represent my constituency, and it was okay if I compromised on things that I believed deeply in. I even made some bad votes or walked votes because this is what I got to do to stay here, and if I'm going to stay here and affect policy, that's what I got to do. And you know, I would make some votes or some or debate something in committee, and I had some senior members come up to me and say, "Ryan, you really ought to switch that vote, or you should maybe think about walking this vote." And my first term up there, I did a lot of that.
What does that mean to walk a vote?
Just get up and you walk out of the chamber.
Ah, okay.
I mean, you just get up and...
You just happen to be missing.
Just get up and go get a drink of coffee.
I was in the restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay.
And...
doggone it, I wanted to make that vote, but I was in the restaurant.
Sure. Yeah. Sure you did. And, you know, I did that for a session. I was pretty miserable with myself. And got, you know, here... You know, my wife and I and our family and this campaign team that had kind of become like an extended family had worked so hard to get me a seat and a vote at the table. And here I am getting up and walking away from it because I'm worried that I'm not going to get to keep that seat another 2 years.
Yeah.
And so that summer, in between my first and my second session, I was just going to law school full time. So I'd do legislative stuff during the day. I'd go to law school. And then I just had a lot of time to really read and think and I got really close to thinking, you know, I'm just not going to go back for that second session. If this is what it is, mm-hmm. then I'm just not going to go back. And I thought, well, no, what the hell? I'll go back and I'll start voting the way that I think I ought to yeah. vote and saying the things that I think ought to be said. And, you know, Carl Albert, you know, there's this, at the Capitol, you often hear these people, they'll come up to you and they'll say, well, Ryan, you know, I don't believe the way that I vote, but my constituency does. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to vote the way my constituency wants me to. And that's just a really, and you can think about that, and it might sound good, but at the end of the day, it's a fool's errand.
And it's not leadership, is it?
It's not leadership.
People elect you. People elect you to be a leader.
Yeah, Carl Albert said, you know, you hear both sides. You know, you listen to your constituencies, you hear them out, but at the end of the day, your vote is your vote.
And what my legislator says, even if they're in the other party, that influences me.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, it does. They're an elected leader. Mm-hmm. They're on TV. They're in the radio studio. Whatever. Yeah. So that approach, just doesn't lead, does it? There's no leadership to that, is there?
Well, there's really no alternative either. I mean, you're not giving voters any sort of a viable alternative.
Right.
And you know, I think that we have seen that in a lot of campaigns from at all levels in Oklahoma over the last several years where. The major party candidates are largely indistinguishable from themselves on a lot of issues that matter to Oklahomans, but frankly, they obscure the issues where there are legitimate and crucial differences between the candidates. And you know, we get in these fights over, you know, who's more of a Christian or who's more pro-life or who loves guns more and all this stuff.
Right,
and at the end of the day, you can't really sit down and have a real conversation about. The state's budget.
What you just defined was how one party is always setting the agenda, and so isn't that the purpose of an opposition party is to offer an alternative agenda?
And I think that opposition party has to push back hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I was fortunate enough. You know, I got to the legislature right on the cusp of term limits, so I had some real. Some real legends around the Capitol that I was able to tap into their mm-hmm. expertise. I had Opio Ture, Representative Opio Ture. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, of all the things I'll ever do in my life, having served in the legislature at the same time as he was and just be a few desks away from Opio was a real treat and a real privilege. Mm-hmm. Debbie Blackburn, Cal Hobson, some people that were mm-hmm. real heroes and mentors of mine. And I think what you saw from them was the ability to push back hard, but to do it in a way that was electorally viable in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Part of it, you know, we can't blame the parties or the politicians too much because for the current status quo, right? I mean, we're definitely in this situation where the middle in Oklahoma isn't a true middle. The middle is very right of center,
right?
Because the platform that you largely see out of the Democratic Party is still, you know, regardless of what folks on the right will have you believe, is not this leftist liberal agenda. It is a very centrist agenda.
Yes.
And it's center right. And so everything, the center in Oklahoma is probably, is left of where the Democrats and the Republicans are.
Right.
But we've got this system that sets that up, and there are a lot of ways that the system incentivizes this this makeup. I think first of all, you've got primary elections.
Yeah,
they're deciding more and more of these elections, and they're largely deciding Republican primaries. Mm-hmm. So you have very few people that are actually deciding who sits up at 23rd and Lincoln. And if you go to the Capitol, and I invite everybody to go up there in session, and just kind of look at the demographics up there. And the demographic, it's pretty vanilla. You know, it's, you know, we have one of the worst representations of women in elected positions. Mm-hmm. We have, from a theological standpoint, everyone is an avowed Christian, now whether they actually are or not. Mm-hmm. You know, but the idea that we would have a Jewish Oklahoman or maybe even an atheist Oklahoman representing us, right. I mean, that seems years down the road. And so you've got these very small groups of people. That's why the legislature, and if you look at 23rd and Lincoln, the capital of 23rd and Lincoln, they don't really look like Oklahoma. And I try to explain that to people around the country.
Right.
You know, when they say, what's going on in Oklahoma? Because they attribute the
capital.
Is that
because only about 20% of the people vote?
20% of the people vote. And in any given election, it can be fewer than that. Mm-hmm. And some of these elections are elected without any sort of opposition. Mm-hmm. So it's zero. And, you know, what's happening out at the Capitol reflects on all of us as Oklahomans. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have to remind myself, just to stay sane, that the Capitol building and what goes on there is so disconnected from right. what's actually going on in this great state of ours.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask a question about that. Would that be what an effective opposition party would do, though, would be to educate people as to why they need to show up and vote?
I think that that's part of it.
If you disagree with this, yeah. show up and vote.
I think that that, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely part of it. And you know, putting a real alternative out there.
Right.
But, you know, to go back to the broken system, because, you know, even under the current system, we can have a brilliant opposition party, and I don't think it gets us anywhere. We have these things called single-member majority districts.
Right.
And we're electing, you know, so in the House, you've got 101 House seats. I'll just use the House for an example. Every one of those House seats, the person that wins and goes to the Capitol to represent, you know, there's 38,000 some odd Oklahomans, every one of them has to get 50% of the vote plus one vote. 50%
right.
plus one vote. Now, and whether that's in a primary or a general election, I think it creates either, if you've just got a primary, well, then you're going to cater to this very small segment of
right.
voters
right.
that's not representative.
20% of the population.
Yeah. Right. yeah. Well, 50% of 20%, right? So even smaller, right?
50%, yeah. 10%.
So 10%
of the population.
Right. Or if you've got a general election, you've got two candidates that are trying to be everything to everybody.
Right.
And in the process being nothing to
right. To anybody.
To anyone.
Right.
And so, yeah, I really think that if we're ever going to see our democratic process work in Oklahoma, where we have, you know, not where no one's got a monopoly on grabbing the microphone and spitting out their ideas for yeses or noes on the House floor, we've got to have proportional representation. Mm-hmm. We've got to do away with this idea that you have to get 50% plus one of the votes to be in the legislature. And let's, instead of having 101 House seats, let's have 20 House seats, with each of us electing five. Mm-hmm. And the top five vote getters go. And I think that it'll break up the two-party system. You know, I'm a registered Democrat, but my allegiance to the two-party system is out the window.
Right.
You know, I think that we would do much better with more voices and more choices at the ballot box.
Wow. Okay. Just in the closing moments here, Ryan, what do you think is the biggest intersection that the legislature is going to face here in this next legislative session?
I think so. It's the budget. I mean, we've said that for year after year after year.
Self-imposed problem.
You know, it's totally artificial. This isn't some law of, it's not like the law of thermodynamics or something like that, right? I mean, it doesn't like exist in and of itself. It exists because they created it. The folks at the legislature created this problem.
Yeah.
And every year they make it worse. And now we're having like a garage sale. The governor's saying we need to sell surplus property basically it's like a fire sale, you know, to pay for the bills.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't even come close to the magnitude of the budget crisis that we're really in.
Is that responsible government?
Absolutely, it's not. And it's wildly irresponsible government. And rather than telling state agencies that have been taking double-digit hits to their budget since 2008, rather than telling them, oh, hey, well, you guys, you know, to really tighten your belt and find another 10%, well, you've been tightening it. I mean, there's, you know, you just can't tighten it anymore. Rather than doing that, why don't we have a real conversation about, do we really need to give a tax break to the wealthiest Oklahomans and set to go into effect in January? Can't we just hit the pause button on that? Use some of your political leadership to do that. You know, the folks that are at the Capitol today, that are in control, have all the strings. They want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to destroy the revenue model without taking any of the blame for the reduction in state services, whether that's roads and bridges or mental health or what have you. Everybody's taking hits. And I think that it's really incumbent upon the agency heads. We've got term limits that has just destroyed institutional knowledge among elected officials.
Right.
But a lot of these agency heads have been around for a long time, whether in their current position or they've just been with the agency for decades. And I think that it's really incumbent upon them to express to the people of Oklahoma the type of pain that they're feeling and that all of us are about to feel pretty soon, because what has emboldened the current attitude out at the Capitol is this sense that we can keep cutting the revenue, and then folks like me get on the radio or on TV and we say, oh my gosh, the sky's going to fall because we're cutting state services. And I mean, and if you're with the Department of Rehabilitative Services and you know that there are people with severe disabilities, they're waiting 6-7 years for services. They're on a wait list that are 6-7 years long. I mean, you get it, right? You recognize it. But most of us, you know, we don't really see it in our day-to-day lives.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so we go to the ballot box and we send the same people back to the legislature, the same people back to the governor's mansion, and they look at that. And we're just kind of like, okay, well, whatever, you can go back. But they look at that as an endorsement. They look at that as a mandate to keep doing what they've been doing.
Yeah.
And until we really
without any organized, unified opposition voice, that's what happens, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, Ryan, the ACLU, biggest intersection for the ACLU coming up in this coming year.
Oh, man. I think that, the biggest civil rights, civil liberties issue facing our current generation is our mass incarceration crisis. Our criminal justice system is so broken and in such desperate need of reform that it is, I think, the civil rights movement of our time to address. Everything from the impact, the disparate impact it has on individuals on the basis of race, income and geography. We have watched as entire communities and neighborhoods have been destroyed. We've watched multi-generational destruction of families. And at the end of the day, as you and I sit here, we're not safer. You know, this idea that you and I are going to be more safe by the current policies being in effect is just a total fabrication. It is not that case at all. In fact, you and I are less safe as a result of these policies because we're incarcerating folks that ought not to be incarcerated.
Right.
Then we turn them back into society with massive fines and fees on their backs, a limited ability to get a job, an even more limited ability in some instances to get a higher education dollar. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And then we're, you know, surprised, shock and awe, that these folks end up back in prison.
Ryan Kiesel, thank you very much. It's been a great session.
Hey,
thank you.
A blast.
Thank you for being on this podcast.
Yeah,
I really
absolutely
appreciate it.
Thanks, Brett.
That concludes the interview. Thank you for listening. This podcast idea came from taking a hard look at the many intersections in my life and listening to the intersections that other people talk about in their own lives. I want to hear about your intersections. My email address is ideas@intersectionsok.com. You can also communicate with me on Twitter and Instagram at intersectionsok. Also, take a look at the website at intersectionsok.com. Steven Tyler is the producer, and I am your host, Brett Dickerson.